My name is Bernard Fernandez. I'm a teacher at the Trotter Elementary School, fourth grade. Grew up here in Boston. 28 years old. My whole life I was in Boston Public Schools. The first thing I would say, just for me showing up a little bit late, is that one thing I know about good teachers is that good teachers are never ever late. Good teachers are never late.
Neither are radio.
You are wrong.
But great teachers show up when they want to.
So. So you're a great teacher.
No, that's... I'm a first-year teacher. And I think what first-year teacher translates into in some other language is a year of trial and error. It's a very challenging time, and it's a very heartbreaking time, and it's a very rewarding time all at the same time, because you get to touch on so many people's lives, but how you touch their lives can go in so many different directions. My girlfriend just showed up. She's also a teacher. She's in the middle school range of teaching, and she'll be able to tell you more about the same amount about the teaching as I can, but more about the experience with the disability and the career. I can answer any questions that you have.
My question is for both of you, what grades do you teach, and is it difficult?
Well, I'm
teaching
in fourth grade.
Is it difficult teaching fourth graders?
Yes, absolutely.
Like how?
Absolutely. What grade are you in now?
Eighth grade.
You're in eighth grade. So 4 years ago, fourth graders are probably a lot different than they are today. That means I'm 28, which means that was like 18 years ago. And 18 years ago, kids were completely different than they are today. But there are so many things now as a teacher and as an older person, and I feel young, but when I'm around the kids, I feel very old, because there are so many things other than your own life that you have to keep up with. For instance, when I first started teaching, I had no idea what Yu-Gi-Oh meant.
Yu-Gi-Oh?
Yu-Gi-Oh. Now,
what?
Yu-Gi-Oh, as it turns out, is like a cartoon.
Oh, yeah, that show.
A video game and a...
favorite show.
Yeah.
I tell you about it.
And just like things like that. Like, there are a million different video game systems now you have to know. Every wrestler you have to know. Every song on the radio you have to know. In order to keep up with the times and in order to know whether a kid's doing something they should be doing or shouldn't be doing. The technology is one of the most difficult things because there's just so much of it and it changes so rapidly. But also the kids nowadays, I feel like, grow up. A fourth grader now may have some of the experiences and maybe even the street smarts of a high school student, because they see just so much in their lives these days. And as Kenny mentioned, just the access to so much information via the internet, television, and radio, they can learn a lot more. And that includes things that can affect them positively or negatively. So they take in so much, they're very much sponges at that age, and with so much coming at them, they take in a lot, they ask a lot, they hold a lot, and they expect a lot, I think. Knowing so much now and with so much entertainment at their fingertips, keeping them interested in learning something in the classroom, you have to be the ultimate entertainer. You'd have to be Michael Jackson in the classroom to get the kids to know something. So
you kind of have to make, you could still teach them things, but you can, like, for fourth graders, what my teacher used to do, she used to make the lessons a little fun.
Yeah, you have to. You definitely have to. And that goes for anyone, whether they're first graders or they're graduate school students. Like, if they're not interested, they're not going to want to learn it, and they're not going to learn what it is you're trying to teach them. So
you're legally blind, or?
Yes.
Tell me, sir, how do you function in the classroom? I don't think you don't use a cane or a guide dog.
No, I don't use either. As far as mobility goes, I can see well enough to get around without tripping over too many things. I do here and there bump into the occasional building. Or
when they're moving.
Yeah, when they're moving.
They always jump in front.
Trees when they jump in your way.
Yeah.
The great thing about education is that it's such a diverse field that you come across so many different types of people, and that includes people with disabilities. And so there are a lot of supports in place for people who have disabilities or things that they need to be able to do the job. And to make sure that those people are able to do their job to the best of their abilities, Boston Public Schools puts in place a lot of supports for those people. So for myself, I have another adult in the classroom with me at all times.
So kids don't take advantage or try to take advantage
exactly
of what you can't see.
Exactly. And at the same time, that's definitely one aspect, and the other one is a safety issue. If I can't see what kids are doing, it could definitely lead to a more terrible situation. She does a little bit of both, but she's there with me all the time. I couldn't get her to come in today. She was sleeping in.
My name is Ethna Riley, and I teach 7th grade at the McCormick Middle School. I teach teach social studies, which in seventh grade is a world geography course.
Well, how does it feel to be a teacher for both? You can both answer this question.
It's absolutely amazing. When you have your own classroom, you get to create your own little world. It's like your own little community. And in that community, the people involved get to take it in any direction they want. And let me follow that statement up by saying, not any direction, like we can't do complete craziness. But within the realm of what is reasonable, you can take your classroom in so many different directions. And if you just were to walk down the hallway of a school and walk past like the open doors of classrooms, you could hear so many different, just the atmosphere that you pass by, and the smells and the sounds that you go by.
Like, is the work harder for you working with kids? Like, do kids like act up in your class sometimes? Do they want to do something?
Yes, the short answer is yes. I think middle school especially, I mean all ages, kids have a lot on their minds. Some days they want to be there, some days they don't. I think it links a lot into what Bernard was saying about creating a classroom community. And that's probably, I'd say, where at least half of our energy goes into, especially as first year teachers, is trying to create a classroom space that welcomes people and helps kids want to be there and has them excited about what they're doing. Because you fall too short on any of those things, the problems that you face will be a lot greater. I wouldn't say kids just, you know, come in and act up it for the heck of it, so to speak. You know, there's reasons behind it, and I think it's very possible to create a space or where students are engaged enough that's not a major issue. But it does take practice, and it is definitely a struggle, I'd say, especially as a first-year teacher. It's definitely part of what we deal with.
And there are classes that we take that are geared specifically towards dealing with behaviors in the classroom. So even as veteran teachers, people still struggle with the behavior in the classroom.
What do you guys do for behavior purposes?
Now they have very sophisticated ways of dealing with students. There are a lot of different ways to approach every situation. What we learned is that every student's behavior or misbehavior, as it were, has one of four motivations, usually. And they were power, revenge, attention, or avoidance of failure. Let's start with revenge. Sometimes a kid misbehaves because he or she is trying to pay you back for something that you did to him or her.
Like, say, if you got him in trouble for something.
Exactly.
Or if a student feels disrespected, especially, I mean, at my age level in middle school, kids are less, they're in a different place as far as their independence, and they're not necessarily under as much of their parents' control or anything as they were before. So it's the age where, as a teacher, you need to start creating a different foundation for discipline or I mean, it's throughout the grades, but by the time you get to middle school, it becomes very crucial that it's based on mutual respect. Because I can be pretty sure that if I come at a student and I disrespect them, that's going to come back to me
Absolutely.
At some point or another. So then no matter how disrespectful they're being, that I make sure that I try to respect students at all times, because revenge can definitely be on the agenda or a reason behind misbehavior.
Absolutely. You have to be specially trained to ever touch a student. If a student is in the classroom or in the school environment and could pose a threat to other students, even at that point, you have to find someone else on the premises who is specially trained to deal with restraining students. We cannot put your hands on students at all. So handcuffs, definitely not going to work.
Our unit today is focusing on an informational interview. We have a set of questions here that we are focusing on to give Dayan and Chris an idea of how to conduct an informational interview. And the first one of our four questions is, how did you get into this field in the first place? And how did you get into your current job?
I went to grad school for education. And the way that I got into grad school is I was recruited. There is a shortage of males in the classroom as far as teachers go. Definitely here in Boston, that is the truth. So they were looking to recruit more males. And I just happened to be a male, so they said, hey, you want to teach? I said, I would like to teach. And they put me into the program. It was a one-year program. Both Ethna and I were in the same program. It's called the Boston Teacher Residency. And it was grueling. 13 months, I think, of just like giving up your whole life to education. After that, because the program is pretty well renowned here in the city, they have a lot of connections to the schools. So when the time rolls around to start looking for jobs, they recommend you and people know the name, and you know, you get your interviews. And they also had job fairs. Boston Public Schools holds these big job fairs where you can go in and just interview and stuff like that. So that's how I ended up in my current job.
So you went to college?
Yes, I went to UMass Amherst for undergrad.
And what did you study there?
There I started off as psychology, which is, I think, it might not be the same today, but when I was there in 99, it was the most popular major for incoming students.
Mm-hmm.
So first-year students at any college at that time, the most popular major was psychology. And that's what I wanted to do even before I knew that statistic. The problem is that once you get there, the statistic that follows is that like 90% of the people who go into psychology graduate with different majors. So I changed to, I ended up graduating with a degree in political science with a focus on international affairs. And then after college, I was supposed to go into the politics arena, but I worked there for just a little while and I just didn't like it. It's a very competitive and very cutthroat business. It just wasn't for me. So I decided to take another route.
Ethna, you went to college too?
Yes, I went to Wesleyan University in Connecticut. And, excuse me, I graduated with a double major in sociology and African American studies. Neither of which were history or geography, but it kind of gave me some of the foundations to go into that field.
Yes, now how come in high school they don't teach or middle school, they don't teach the same classes in college, like psychiatry or something.
Oh, you're saying why don't they teach like the college subjects?
Yes.
I think that sometimes, I don't want to say that they're too advanced, but I think there are definitely still in middle school, there are basics that they want the students to know before they move on to those more enriching courses like psychiatry. Before you do psychiatry, they want you to know where Africa is on the globe or, you know, the capital of the United States. But you might be surprised that so many students don't know. So a lot of the basics that they want students to have before they move on to those, or maybe before they can move on to those more intriguing and more challenging subjects, they teach in middle school, elementary and middle school. They give you the basics.
When you first start teaching, like the very first day we walked into this school, both of you can answer this. How did y'all feel about it? How did y'all think the students were going to be acting?
You go for it.
Nervous. It's very, very nerve-wracking. The principal told me the day before school started, as long as you know, nobody sleeps tonight. And it's true. A lot of teachers don't sleep the night before school starts because it's with the same stresses that students have. What's it going to be like? Is it going to be fun? Is everything going to go well? Am I going to be successful? Teachers have those same worries. The good news is, because it's a shared worry, everybody tends to be on their best behavior. Teachers and students alike. So the start is actually a lot smoother than I at least anticipated. And I kind of cruised through the first couple weeks of school. It was a pleasant surprise.
Did you guys give like homework on the first day? And like, how is homework for you two?
I did give homework on the first day.
As well.
Yes.
Both did it?
Easy homework, though.
Yeah, very easy.
You did?
Yeah, definitely.
I gave a welcome sheet. So just, what's your name? Who do you live with? Favorite food?
Oh, yeah.
What's great about you?
Something fun.
Yeah. Related question. You can put to rest nerve and religion. Do teachers have homework?
Absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
More than the kids.
Yeah. Way more than the kids.
You have to grade all the kids.
Yeah, definitely. Planning is a huge part of your life as a teacher.
For every hour you spend in the classroom, usually a lot of teachers spend up to 3 hours planning that hour.
Do y'all do it in the school? Because some teachers, like in my school, they usually stay at the school.
Yeah.
Because my school has an after-school program. So some of the teachers stay, like if they need, like some of the students need help or something. Do you guys do that?
I do every day. The school gets out around 1:45, and kids are usually there with me till about 2:45, and I'm usually there till about 5:45.
Whoa.
So, yeah, it's definitely an after.
School starts for me at 8:30. It goes to 3:30. I'm usually there by 7:30, and I usually leave about 6:30 at night. So
that's a long day.
Yeah, it is.
The second question on our list of four questions is
such a...
Go ahead, Dan.
What kind of things do you like the most about this job?
Children. It's got to be children. The motto for Boston Public Schools is focus on children. And if you don't love kids, you really should not be teaching. And if you're not ready to dedicate yourself to just, like, trying to educate others and, like, trying to... It's much more than just classroom stuff. Like, it's also a lot of life lessons, I feel like, when you're teaching kids. If you're not ready to give all of yourself to a classroom of students, I would say that it's definitely not the profession for you. But sometimes when I think about being a fourth grade teacher, it's like, I almost feel like it's cheating, you know? Like, someone pays me every day to wake up and go into a building and play with 10-year-olds all day long. And at some point I trick them into playing something that's going to teach them something, but, you know, it's like being a kid all over again with all the benefits of being an adult. But I think that's one of the things I love most about the job.
I would say the thing I love most about my job is, say, those aha moments when the being able to watch kids grow and to watch students progress in their social skills and their learning and whatever it may be that we're focusing on at the time. That when it's, if it's a student producing a project that they're proud of and that's beautiful and that shows what they've learned, that's always exciting to me. And or if it's watching them do better socially in the classroom and take step by those baby steps of learning how to treat each other with respect and honor each other students and kind of break out of some of these negative lessons that we learn. That's progress a long time is definitely probably the most rewarding part of my job.
And off the record, you get 2 solid months of vacation every year. So that's awesome.
I think the kids enjoy that part too.
We haven't experienced it yet. It's gonna be very
soon. It's coming. The days?
Absolutely. 40 days left.
Okay, the third question is the flip side of that same question. What kind of things do you like the least about your job?
I'd say there's 2 things. Kind of same one, but the teaching is a very emotional business, I find. In that it's so exciting and rewarding and inspiring, and there are moments in the classroom where I'm almost brought to tears by the pride that I feel towards what my kids are accomplishing, what my students are accomplishing. But the flip side is true as well. When a child is giving up or is fighting with you, that, you know, you feel like you're having to pull teeth to get them to participate in their own education, when kids have so much on their mind that they can't focus, and all the different things that make it difficult. It can be very, very difficult to not take it personal and to not get down about it. Teaching is something that you, especially as a first-year teacher, you need to be okay with failing to some extent or another every single day. And knowing that you're going to try your hardest and you're going to do your best, but there's going to be something that you didn't do well enough or that you messed up on. And you got to just pick it back up, learn from your mistakes, and try to do it better the next day. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the challenges can be very, very daunting at times.
When you say grit your teeth and not participate, what do you mean by that?
I feel like my job as a teacher should be to help students learn. I'm there to help them explore things, to help them find the information, to help them build their skills. And my job, I feel, should ideally be as a facilitator and a supporter in that process. And yes, sometimes, especially in, well, I'd say across grade level, but it can be in middle school, where kids are not in the mood. They don't feel like being there, and they're not interested. They're not yet looking towards graduation, and they don't really get what the point is, and they just don't want to do it. They don't want to learn. They feel like they don't care. And sometimes I find myself, like, fighting with kids to get them to learn. And that's definitely not how it should be. And it can be very frustrating and discouraging when that dynamic arises.
Thank you for that. Explain the question.
Bernard, do you have anything comes to mind? The least?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of leasts, which is against the meaning of the word. But I'd probably say the biggest one is combating all of the negative, I'd say, thoughts and emotions that the students have for themselves. I don't know if it's a fourth grade phenomenon, but definitely, like, the students are very much down on themselves and their abilities, and they're not enjoying the educational experience. Like, I remember loving fourth grade, but I feel like these students come into the building every day not as happy as I think or I would like a fourth grader to be. And so every day they come in, and it's just kind of, after a while, like so many people in a building in a bad mood or just like in a challenging place, it wears on you. Even if it's not you, even if you came in a great mood but your kids are feeling down, like you take it very personal. And as Ethna said, it's very much an emotional thing, and you try not to take personal insults personal. But when someone insults your students, or if your students are insulting each other, you take it very, very personal.
Yeah.
That's your time to be emotional. And so it definitely does take its toll on you, absolutely. Like, some of these students are so brilliant and doing things nowadays that I can't do now as an adult. I see my students in music class reading music and writing music, and I tell them that I have no clue how to do it, and they're just amazed by it. And at the very same time, during the same day, at a different time, those same students will feel like they're not smart at all. They'll call themselves stupid. They'll say that they can't achieve. And I think that, for me, is the thing I like the least.
In the news about the MCAS tests in the portfolio, do you guys cheat on the MCAS?
No, you can't
this
cheat
is being
on the
recorded, Dion. You expect this?
No, you can't cheat on the MCAS. The MCAS, I feel like they treat MCAS more seriously than jury duty. You know what I mean? Like, the MCAS is serious business. You get it in this little locked box, and you have to have it in your sight at all times. Students can't touch the box. No one but the classroom teacher can touch it. You have to sign out for it. And then once they have the test, as teachers, I'm not supposed to see the test at all. When the students take the test, I'm not supposed to know what the question is. I'm not supposed to know what their answer to the question is.
Wow.
At any point until the tests are scanned and scored. I think they said a couple of years ago when the MCAS first came out, which was like 2000, was it 2000? 2000 was the first year because I didn't take it in 99. So it must have been 2000 was the first year. It was one page of instructions. One page of instructions and restrictions. And it was probably about half a page. Now it's maybe like a 60 or 70 page booklet.
Wow.
Of administration instructions.
Wow.
You read word for word.
Word for word, you have to read it to the students, and you have to follow it to
the... Did you read the whole book to the students?
Not the entire book, no. But there are specific directions for
every section.
Do you also do portfolio MCAS? Because I've heard you have special needs as well.
Yes, absolutely. But every student has a portfolio. So even for the students who aren't special needs, we have portfolios for them. And their MCAS scores go into those. But the beautiful thing about the portfolios is that the MCAS, at least at my grade level in elementary school, the MCAS only holds but so much weight. It's not until you get into the later grades that it's very much a large part of your portfolio.
Good job. Thank you for answering that question. I know it's really hard for you to answer.
I could talk to you about MCAS.
There are a lot of books and movies about teachers and students. Mm-hmm. And I think of like Freedom Riders and Stand and Deliver and those kind of things. Were either of you inspired by any books or movies about teaching to help you get into this job?
I'd say The Peanuts.
Peanuts?
Yeah, Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
You ever watch Charlie Brown?
Yeah.
The teacher's like, I think the Peanuts, when they asked me, like, would you consider teaching? And I was just like, I can make myself sound like that. Let me see. Any books or movies that inspire? No, I don't think so. Not for me.
We're talking about, you know, we work with kids who are blind, visually impaired. I have a friend who years ago wanted to be a teacher in Boston Public School. He's totally blind. They wouldn't really hire him to do it. And you talked about the supports that the school offers at present. I'd be interested in hearing what are some of those supports. And then I suppose the second thing is, I mean, if you could just talk about how do you do it. I mean, you talk about having this person in your class, but the kids give you homework. And so how do you check the homework? Do you use any adaptive equipment to do that?
I'll answer the second one first because I think it'll be quicker. Yes, I do use adaptive technology in the classroom because I have some vision. I use a closed circuit television, CCTV, and it's amazing. Like the BPS, they have an office specifically for teachers or educators with disabilities. I can't think of the name of the office off the top of my head, but and so that office came to my classroom and sat down with me and asked me like what type of supports I would need. And like what technologies, and they told me I'd have another adult in the classroom at all times. But I do use a closed circuit television, and nowadays they're keeping up with the technology. So my first closed circuit television back in the 90s, it was like black and white. It was like kind of lopsided. It was the worst thing ever. It was like I felt like I could see better without it. And now they're like in color, they're high definition, big screen,
wow.
Motorized, they're all types of things. You can hook them to computers, to printers, to scanners. I use that in the classroom. As far as supports go, they have, as I said, an office set up specifically for educators and future educators with disabilities. A gentleman named Larry Faison heads up the office. He was very much a big help in everything that's gone on in my classroom thus far, like as far as making sure that it's set up in a safe manner and making sure that I can access everything in the school. And like the BPS goes very much beyond just your school building. Like there are so many schools and so many different places to do trainings, and they make sure that I always have knowledge of how to get to those places or access to getting to those places. So I would say that the school district definitely does a lot to help out. It's very surprising to hear that the person you know wouldn't be hired. I'm pretty sure that not hiring a blind person is illegal.
Wow. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
Homework checking, my parrot does that. That's one of the lazy things that I could do myself, but I choose not to. She can do it 10 times faster. And so I use her for things like that.
Yeah.
But that's specifically what she's there for. Her function is to do all the things that other teachers in the building can do that take me a little bit more time. She's there to keep me on pace.
And then what about the planning?
I do all my planning. She's involved in the planning as far as what sort of tasks I'm gonna need her to do.
Mm-hmm.
So work like overhead projectors are very difficult for me because it's just a light shining straight into your face, and you have to write on it and be able to read it. So for me, it's very tough. So for things like that, if I need her to use overhead projectors or to write on charts, to monitor behavior, I tell her all those things from the plan. But other than that, all of the curriculum stuff I do on my own.
I knew you, both of you probably took interviews and information interviews, right?
Yep.
Both of you? All right. How'd that go? Did that go good?
Our interview process to get our jobs?
Yeah.
I interviewed at 3 places. 2 of them I got, 1 of them I turned down, 1 of them I didn't get. And the 3rd one, as you can imagine, is where I'm at now. But as I said, the name of our program carries a lot of weight in Boston Public Schools, so they definitely put us, our resumes, towards the top of the pile, if not at the very top. So it would be probably the equivalent of like trying to get a job if you went to Harvard or something.
Yeah,
that might be a
big question.
Maybe not that much. But
you have
close.
To be a student to get in that school.
Yeah, absolutely. You gotta work very hard to get in that school.
So how many tests do you have to take to become a teacher?
It depends on the grade level you wanna go into. If you wanna be an elementary teacher like myself, I had to take 3 tests. They're called MTELs. Massachusetts
Test for Educator Licensure.
Right. And so I had to take 3 of those tests, and each test had 2 subtests in it. Basically 6 little tests.
What's a subtest? Can you give an example?
I think each test session was 4 hours long. Was it for the MTEL?
3 or 4 hours.
And so each test would take about half that time. So maybe 1.5 to 2 hours each test. The first test you have to take is called Communication and Literacy. All teachers have to take that test. And that's basically how well you can read and how well you can write. And it's like multiple choice. And it would be like your basic English test probably, just really big, like the English portion of the SATs. And then you have to take, like I said, a writing test. I had to take another reading test that tests your ability to teach other people to read. That's called Foundations of Reading.
Ooh, how felt that test?
Oh man, that test was tough. That was very tough. But the toughest one that I took, and Ethna didn't have to take Foundations of Reading either. She did have to take Communication and Literacy. And then the 3rd test that I had to take was called General Curriculum. Now, General Curriculum is probably the worst test that I've ever taken in my life.
What do you mean? Explain that. I will explain this.
I love to explain this to people. This is the way I keep future teachers from taking my job. General Curriculum is a 3 or 4 hour test that covers everything, anything, and everything. So it's 100 questions. 100 multiple choice questions and 2 full essays. Within that 100 questions, the range of questions varies from physics to geography, all sorts of math, science, literature, everything.
Wow. So
anything you can imagine.
So the test that you took was the hardest one. It's basically like all the 8th grade MCATs we had to take combined, right?
Maybe. I never had to take MCAT, so I'm not quite sure, but I can imagine.
It sounds harder than that. Was that at a public testing center, or was that hit through your program, your 13-month program?
It was a public testing center.
Uh-huh.
All teachers who teach in Boston Public Schools have to take it to be licensed.
Did they provide a CCTV for you?
No, not for that. The first time I took the test, I signed up so late that I didn't have the chance to ask for accommodations, which is one of the great things about the test. As I said, education is a very diverse field, so they are used to making accommodations for people taking the test. First time I took it, I have a globe magnifier, like a little bubble magnifier.
Uh-huh.
And so because I didn't have the chance to sign up for accommodations, because you have to do it a certain time in advance, and I missed the deadline, I had to take it just with my bubble magnifier, which was tough. It was really tough. I got through most of the test. I passed one subtest, the first one, which is the reading, and then I didn't pass the writing because I had to skip an entire section of like 25 questions.
Wow.
To make sure that I had enough time to get to my essays. The thing with the test is that you can fail it as many times as you want, but as many times as you do before you pass it.
Uh-huh.
There's no detriment. So, accept the money, absolutely. It's about $150 every time you take the test.
Ooh.
No, about $100 every time you take the test. But the next time, all the other tests subsequently that I took, I got a large print and extended time. They do make great accommodations.
The extended time, in some ways, is a blessing, and other ways, it's a curse, because it just means you extend the pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had to take 2 tests. The first one was the same as Renard, Communications and Literacy. And then I actually ended up taking the humanities test because I wasn't sure exactly, what I was going to be teaching, whether it was going to be history, history and English, and so on. So I took the humanities, which is a combination of like history, geography, English. It was probably one of the most random tests I've ever taken in my life. The questions that they asked me on there, some of them were completely obvious to me, and others were just so obscure that it's like, why would anyone know that? But as I mentioned, I was an African American studies major, so I had taken a fair amount of literature courses, and that I also had some great English classes in high school that were able to help me out with that. And then I got lucky that one of the long responses was a geography question, and I had been in part of the Boston Teacher Residency Program is that you do a year-long internship, actually working in a classroom and taking on teaching responsibilities as the year progresses. So I had more or less taught most of a geography class the year before in my residency year, so I got lucky that I was able to for that part of the test.
Like, if you two weren't teachers, what job would you want to be? If you could have any job in the world?
I would say I would want to be a screenwriter. I'd like to write for TV and movies.
Like what kind of movies? Action, adventure,
drama? Comedy and action, I would say.
Yeah.
No romance for me. I could not write you a romance movie. My life depended on it. Comedy and action, I could do.
I thought the careers I thought about, or one other career that I considered, was a law career. My basic mission, I was raised in a household of people that our number one priority that my parents raised me with is trying to make positive change. That I grew up in a household that's a shared living community with refugees of war and adults with disabilities. That's always been, my focus since a child is being aware of some of the things that are wrong in the world and really trying to figure out, given my interests and talents, what is the way that would be most effective for me to create the biggest positive change that I could. And that's what landed me in teaching, but I did think about law for a while, and I did think about social work as well.
So, like, in law, you would probably be, like, a soldier, a cop, a fireman?
I would have been interested in being a defense lawyer. Either working on legislation or defense, probably the opposite of cops, in a way.
And what's a shared living community?
My mother founded an organization in 1990 called the House of Peace, And basically, part of it is based off of a model called the Camp Hill model, which is an international model in which you have communities of households that have could have a house mother, house father, their biological children, and several villagers, which are adults with various handicaps that live as part of the household family and that work in the village, and like, they have share a bakery and so on. So that's where I was born and lived till I was six, and my parents had lived for a long time before then. Like I said, though, my mother founded the House of Peace, which was a similar model. It's her and my stepfather run it. My brothers and I grew up in it, and for years she took in foster children from war-torn countries, so unaccompanied refugee minors and other victims of war that needed a either transitional or semi-permanent place to live when they arrived in the United States. Mm-hmm. And she combined that with the shared living with adults with disabilities. So there's a kind of core community of, right now it's four adults that live in and work as part of the House of Peace as permanent residents. No, it's in Ipswich, Massachusetts, so it's about 45 minutes from here.
Nice. Well, we all appreciate you coming in, giving up your valuable Saturdays, and
yeah,
how important nice weekends are for teachers.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure to talk
to you. Thank you very much.